This is World Lutheran News Digest, an audio news magazine bringing you a look at significant events in worldwide Lutheranism. WLN Digest is produced through the facilities of Worldwide KFUO, a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
Today on World Lutheran News Digest,
I'm World Lutheran News Digest host Kip Allen. Dr. Ben Carson, who's seeking the Republican presidential nomination, was criticized recently for saying the U.S. should not elect a Muslim president. A pediatric neurosurgeon was accused of ignoring the Constitution, which prohibits religious tests for public office, and of Islamophobic bigotry. His critics ignored that Carson was referring specifically to two concepts found in mainstream Muslim theology, Sharia and Taqiyya. Sharia is the written law of Allah that devout Muslims believe supersedes all human law. Taqiyya is a belief that it's acceptable for a Muslim to lie to non-Muslims under certain conditions. To further explain these two concepts, I speak with Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch and author of 14 books, two of which made the New York Times bestseller list. He tells World Lutheran News Digest that Dr. Carson's concerns are well-founded.
And now today's Fast Track.
Here's news in brief of interest to Lutherans worldwide. The Lutheran and Roman Catholic churches have been at odds for a long time. But on some issues, there's total agreement. One such issue is the sanctity of life. On October 6th of this year, the Reverend Dr. Matthew Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and Archbishop Robert Carlson of the St. Louis Archdiocese issued a joint statement in the wake of a series of videos depicting Planned Parenthood officials discussing the harvesting of organs from aborted babies. Harrison says in the wake of these revelations, both Christian faiths say no.
It does not happen often that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and Roman Catholics speak together on a social issue. It's high time, in the wake of the revelations regarding Planned Parenthood, that we say no, no more.
Both denominations abhor the practice of abortion and resolutely oppose it. Harrison notes that both faiths offer assistance to women and families and that they should know that there are many alternatives to abortion.
Our consciences as citizens and Christians cannot allow us to sit back and watch what has happened and what is evident to all continue to happen without decrying it, saying no, and also making known the fact that we offer assistance for women who find themselves in challenging circumstances.
The joint statement reads, and I quote, "It would be easier to forget what we have seen, to erase it from our memories and our minds and what we have heard, but the statements and actions of Planned Parenthood medical directors and technicians captured on film and released by the Center for Medical Progress are the kind that we will not forget, the kind that we cannot unsee and unhear. Like millions of Americans, including those in the Roman Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, we have been shaken to the core by what we have witnessed. Intact babies, at times still alive, having their body parts harvested as a commodity. We are shocked at the image of tiny hands and feet seen in a glass pie plate. We are horrified at what we have seen and heard. Such actions and attitudes have no place in our society. While offensive, the degradation of the bodies of these infant human beings is unfortunately just the tip of the iceberg. Those fetal tissue and organs are only available for sale because they are being killed through abortion. Over 57 million unborn children have been lost to abortion in our nation since 1973. The toll of these lives lost is enormous. We're missing sons and daughters, siblings, spouses, coaches, scholars, mentors, and friends. This loss is symptomatic of a loss of respect for human life in our society today. In so many ways, our culture seeks to deny the humanity of the unborn, of the elderly, or of someone with a disability. Together, we stand firm and repeat that every human life is worthy of dignity and respect. We affirm our continued commitment to offer resources to help parents of any faith background who are in need of medical, financial, or social service assistance, both during pregnancy and after. We stand ready to assist any parent who wishes to make an adoption plan for their child. Our commitment is to all life in all stages from conception to natural death. For those men and women who have participated in an abortion, we extend to you the words of Jesus, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy burdened." And we invite you to experience hope and healing from your experience. World Lutheran News Digest will be back right after these messages.
Hi, I'm Pastor Mark Hawkinson, host of Moments of Assurance, Sunday at 9:15 a.m. right here on KFUO Radio. Each week, I have the privilege of producing a quarter hour of message, music, and prayer blended together to fit a special theme for that day. You'll hear messages of hope and complete confidence in Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. You'll hear choirs and instrumentals to support the message as well. So I invite you to join me. That's Moments of Assurance, Sunday morning at 9:15 a.m.
Este é a Notícias Luteranas pelo Mundo. This is World Lutheran News Digest.
I'm Kip Allen, host for World Lutheran News Digest. My guest today is Mr. Robert Spencer, who is the director of Jihad Watch. He is an expert in areas of radical Islam and is a best-selling author. Mr. Spencer, could you tell me a little bit about yourself, about your background, how you got involved in Jihad Watch and this type of movement?
Sure. Jihad Watch started in October 2003. Because I was looking for a single website that would have jihad news and commentary to help people understand the news. And since it didn't exist, I had to invent it. And so that's been going since then. And also I'm the author of 14 books on various aspects of Islam and jihad, including the latest, The Complete Infidel's Guide to ISIS.
The thing that has struck me recently is Ben Carson, who is seeking the Republican nomination for president, came under fire recently when he said that he would have trouble supporting a Muslim for president. Now, of course, he came under fire immediately for there was a constitutional prohibition against religious tests. However, religion certainly shapes a person's worldview, and the media had no problem inquiring about Mitt Romney's religion and how it would affect him. Part of the problem, I think, with Dr. Carson was saying was that there is this concept of taqiyya and, of course, sharia that, in his mind, is a real problem. Can you explain what these two concepts mean, sir?
Sure. Dr. Carson got a lot of heat from the media for speaking about taqiyya as a general concept because, as their so-called fact-checkers pointed out, taqiyya is a Shiite concept, and Shiites are only 10 to 15% of Muslims worldwide. But the reality is that while the specific term taqiyya and the specific formulation of that concept as such is indeed Shiite, religious deception is actually something that is sanctioned in Islam and is based on the Quran, the holy book of Islam itself. Chapter 3, verse 28 says, "Do not take unbelievers as your friends and protectors in preference to believers, unless you're doing it to guard yourself against them." And that clause, "unless you're doing it to guard yourself against them," has been interpreted, is interpreted in mainstream Islamic theology as meaning that when under pressure, when under threat, or in the context of a war with Islam, and remember that many American Muslim leaders have said that the war on terror is a war against Islam, then Muslims are justified in deceiving unbelievers and making them think that they're on their side. And that was what Dr. Carson was referring to, that the idea of a Muslim president is who would be loyal to the Constitution is just fine, but because Islam has a doctrine of religious deception, it's possible that a Muslim could be deceiving people as to the nature of his loyalty to the Constitution. And so Dr. Carson said somebody who has shown by his deeds over a period of years that he holds to the American values that are contradicted by Islamic law, he would have no problem with him being the nominee. But a Muslim who just professes these things and doesn't live by them, then that's another matter. And this brings us to Sharia, which is Islamic law, considered in Islamic theology to be the unalterable, perfect law of God, of Allah. And the problem with Sharia is that it's a comprehensive political system as well as a religious one, and it denies the freedom of speech, the equality of rights of women, the equality of rights of non-Muslims, and numerous other things that are guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution and principles of human rights upon which the Constitution is based. And so Dr. Carson here again is correct that a Muslim who accepts Sharia as the law of Allah and believes in it cannot sincerely uphold the values and the laws of the U.S. Constitution. It's not possible, and he was entirely correct.
My understanding is that the very concept of democracy and republic is anathema to the Islamic world. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. There is no democracy in the Islamic world. There never has been, with the exception of Turkey. But many people point to Turkey and say, see, Islam and democracy are compatible. They don't seem to realize or don't want other people to realize that Islam is that Turkey actually was founded, modern secular Turkey, in the 1920s in the context of a war with Islam, that it was an explicit rejection of political Islam. And consequently, to point to it and say, see, look, Islam is compatible with democracy is completely short-sighted and ahistorical. In reality, there's never been a democracy in the Islamic world that was based on Islamic law and Islamic concepts. Islamic law is inherently authoritarian. The idea is that the laws are set by Allah, including political aspects of society, and that's not negotiable. And so it's only up to the law enforcement officials to enforce those laws and the governing authorities to enforce those laws. It's not up to the parliament to deliberate on what the laws are going to be. Allah has already set all that out.
As you pointed out, Turkey was founded as a rejection to that. Now, Turkey, modern Turkey, is actually an outgrowth of the old Ottoman Empire that collapsed after the end of the First World War. And it was established by Kemal Atatürk, who is very specifically secular. And I think you were quite correct when he said this was an outright rejection of the concept of the caliphate, of the concept of rule by Islam.
Yeah, look, Atatürk abolished the caliphate. The reason why we're dealing with the Islamic State today and it presents itself as a restoration of the caliphate is because ever since Atatürk abolished the caliphate in 1924, the Islamic Jihad groups worldwide have been laboring to restore it, to put it back, because they consider that Islam is not quite Islam without this single global Muslim government to which all Muslims owe allegiance.
Now, also, going back a little bit to the concept of taqiyya, my understanding is that the 9/11 hijackers who came into the United States prior to committing that horrible atrocity had actually disguised themselves as secular. They had shaved their beards, they drank, they did things that were forbidden by Islam, but this was apparently permitted because of taqiyya. Is that correct?
Yes, that's quite right. And the Islamic State makes this explicit, as al-Qaeda did before it, in actually specifically directing its operatives in the West to adopt a secular appearance, to shave their beards, to wear Western dress, to not go to mosque, to not carry around the Quran, but to maintain their Islam in secret and wait for the time when they're ordered to strike.
And the caliphate, as in ISIS right now, the self-styled caliphate, they are a Sunni movement, I believe. Is that correct, too? And
yes,
because we were talking
right
earlier about taqiyya, was the critics are saying, well, that's just a Shiite concept. Yet we have this Sunni movement that apparently adopts the same principle.
Right. See, as I explained, you have the Quran itself sanctioning deception of unbelievers. And so it's impossible to maintain the idea of religious deception as a solely Shiite concept. Taqiyya may arguably be said to be only a Shiite thing, but religious deception is universally Islamic.
They simply use a different term for it in the Sunni faith.
Yes.
I'd like to go a little bit more into Sharia. One other aspect that's been in the news recently, we may recall there was that young boy who had that clock and we got into trouble for that. But his father is quite an activist down in Irvine, Texas. One of the things he's been pushing for are Islamic courts, are Sharia courts within that town. What would a Sharia court do, and how could that possibly be something that could complement or even supersede an American judicial system?
Well, the claim by people like Muhammad al-Hassan, the boy's father, and others who pushed for Sharia courts in the United States is that there'll only be private and voluntary arbitration, and that the court's purview will be limited to the elements of Islamic law that are not at variance with American law. And so they'll only deal with marriage matters and divorce and inheritance and that kind of thing, where there are specific Islamic laws and they will not be dealing with criminal cases. Now, the problem with that claim is that Sharia is comprehensive, and Sharia does cover every aspect of life, and we have already had that assurance made in Britain with the Islamic Sharia courts there. When they were established a few years ago, there were many assurances from Muslim and non-Muslim leaders that they would only apply to these private arbitration matters, marriage cases, and so on, and that they wouldn't interfere with the civil law or with the criminal law. Now, this was immediately belied by the fact that Sharia courts were given cases of spousal abuse, and they took them. Now, spousal abuse is a criminal matter in the UK as well as in the US. But in Islamic law, the Quran says that if a man fears disobedience from a woman, he can beat her. And so wife beating is something that is not frowned upon in Islamic law. And so the spousal abuse cases should have been referred to the criminal courts, but they were not. They were considered to come under the purview of Sharia. And this was a place where Sharia contradicted the law of the land. And the courts overrode their stated authority and usurped the authority of the criminal courts. This kind of thing would be very likely to happen in the United States as well, were these Sharia courts to be established. And Muhammad al-Hassan was one who was trying to establish one in Texas.
We are seeing now a massive migration from the Middle East into Europe, and if President Obama has his way, into the United States as well. Is this something that we should be concerned about?
Oh, absolutely, yes. The Islamic State last February threatened to flood Europe with 500,000 refugees. Not long after that, refugees started flooding into Europe, and anybody who thinks that there's any problem with it is, of course, termed by the media immediately a racist, bigoted Islamophobe. But the question still remains. What kind of jihadi involvement is in this refugee influx, and what should be done about the refugees as a result? And so this is a very important discussion that we need to have, a public discussion, and we're not able to have it because it's clouded over by this sloganeering and these false and baseless charges of racism and bigotry. But in reality, the Lebanese education minister just recently said that as many as 20,000 active jihadis were among the refugees in his country on their way to Europe. And so there's an untold number of jihadis, active jihadis, who are already in Europe with the refugee influx, and more coming all the time.
And we've certainly seen incidents of Islamic violence, say, in France and even in Sweden. Are we looking to see an uptick as this flood continues?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt about it. In the first place, even if the refugees are not active Islamic jihadis, very many of them still hold to the jihadi mindset, the Islamic mindset of supremacism, and the idea that Sharia is superior to the law of the land wherever they are, because it's a non-Muslim legal system, and consequently, they will have very great difficulty. As a matter of fact, it will be virtually impossible for Muslims of that mindset to integrate into the society as a whole.
It seems to me that on the whole, the Western world has not seen a willingness on the part of Islamic migrants to assimilate into our societies. They tend to maintain very much their own communities.
Yes. Absolutely. And this is because, well, the Quran says to Muslims, you are the best people on earth. And it says to non-Muslims that non-Muslims are the most vile of created beings. So you can imagine if you were one of the best of people, you're not going to want to go and live in and among the society of the most vile of created beings. You're going to want to stay with the best of people and shun the most vile of created beings as much as you possibly can.
I contrast that with many of the Jewish communities we have here in the United States, where they have maintained their own distinct culture, yet they are also distinctively American.
Yes, absolutely. And the difference is that Judaism is not supremacist. Judaism is not incompatible with American law. And so there's no problem with assimilating Jews into the United States any more than there's any problem assimilating Hindus or Christians from foreign lands or people of any other religion. The only problem is with Muslims because Islam is the only religion that has a developed doctrine and theology and legal system that mandates the discarding of that the doctrine that mandates the discarding of the societal system of the place of any non-Muslim area and its replacement by Islamic law.
Would it be accurate for me to say that Islam is at its heart a supremacist philosophy?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, the best of people must rule over the most vile of created beings. That's their responsibility, and they have the responsibility also to execute the wrath of Allah. The Quran says that Allah will punish the unbelievers by the hands of the believers, and so it's their responsibility to make sure that the unbelievers suffer as a result of their having rejected Allah and Muhammad and the Quran.
We have an organization here in the United States, CARE, the Council on Islamic-American Relations. They have been linked to such groups as the Muslim Brotherhood, I believe. Also, I think the head of that organization once said that Islam did not come to America to be tolerated as a religion, but to become dominant. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. That was Omar Ahmed, who was the co-founder and the longtime chairman of the board of the Council on American Islamic Relations. And the Council on American Islamic Relations presents itself as a civil rights organization, like a Muslim NAACP. But in reality, it has ties to Hamas, demonstrated by the Justice Department, ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. It's, as we've said, Omar Ahmed said that Islam is not the United States to coexist peacefully with other religions. Islam is in the United States to become dominant. And so this is an organization that has resisted every counterterror measure that has ever been proposed or implemented. And it's had several of its leaders arrested and convicted on various terror-related charges. So it's hardly the organization that it appears to be.
Perhaps another example of taqiyya.
Absolutely, absolutely. CARE is a taqiyya organization because it's designed to mislead Americans about the nature of Islam and the threat of jihad, to make people think that there's something wrong, bigoted, Islamophobic, in CARE's term, for resisting jihad terror, and to render Americans complacent about the jihad threat or too afraid to speak out against it.
If unchecked, what would we see in this country? What is their ultimate goal for the United States?
Ibrahim Hooper of CARE said it himself about 20 years ago in an interview with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. He said, "I wouldn't want to give the impression that I wouldn't like to see the United States government become Islamic sometime in the future." Now, for the United States government to become Islamic, that means the United States adopts Islamic law with its restrictions on the freedom of speech, denial of equality of rights to women, denial of equality of rights to non-Muslims, death penalty to those who leave Islam, and so on. That's what Ibrahim Hooper and CARE want to see for the United States.
The very concept of separation of church and state is alien to the Islamic world. To them, that it's one and the same.
Yes, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, if you read Islamic apologists, they boast about that. And they say Christianity is an incomplete system because it doesn't have a political program, whereas Islam covers every aspect of life, including the political.
A frightening vision for the future.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we're dealing with an aggressive expansionist, supremacist, authoritarian ideology that is advancing in the West via deceit and the complacency and ignorance of our leaders.
One thing that strikes me as I look at a Christian religion and I look at the Jewish religion, and this is a faith, these are faiths where people can die for their faith, but they cannot kill for it. That's not the case with Islam. Killing is actually sanctioned under Islamic law.
Yes. The Quran says in three places, kill them wherever you find them, referring to various groups. And it mandates that for Christians and Jews, that they either submit as inferiors under the rule of Islamic law, or convert to Islam, or be killed. Convert, be subjugated, or die.
Which we've seen in areas of the Middle East where ISIS has taken over, where the non-Muslims have been given that option.
Yes, exactly. And that's precisely because ISIS very scrupulously follows out Quranic imperatives and the imperatives of Islamic law.
Speaking of ISIS, you just now have a new book out on it. Could you tell me about the book?
The Complete Infidel's Guide to ISIS is a more or less lighthearted, and lighthearted because, after all, if you don't laugh, then you're liable to cry. And in any case, I do think that ISIS is a tremendous evil and that mockery is an apposite response in the face of evil, as Thomas More said, the devil is a proud spirit and cannot endure to be mocked. In any case, the Complete Infidel's Guide to ISIS is thus a breezy and lighthearted, but comprehensive and detailed, thorough introduction to what ISIS is all about, to all the things that Barack Obama doesn't want you to know about ISIS. The Complete Infidel's Guide to ISIS shows you who they are, what they're trying to do, how they're going about it, and what we must do to stop them, all the things that the U.S. government is ignoring right now.
One final question for you, sir. As you pointed out, the U.S. government does seem to be ignoring this threat. In fact, they don't even use the word Islamic terrorism. Why?
Well, I think that Barack Obama thinks that he will alienate our Muslim allies if he speaks honestly about the nature and magnitude of this threat. And he thinks that, well, we have Muslims fighting against it, and so we can't deal with its Islamic aspect. But the fact is that, meanwhile, the Islamic State is making recruits among peaceful Muslims by appealing to Islam and Islamic teachings. And unless and until we confront that, we're never going to be able to defeat it. You can't defeat an enemy that you don't understand.
Thank you very much, Mr. Spencer. I appreciate you being on the program.
And, pleasure. Thank you.
And I'm sure we'll be in touch with you in the future. World Lutheran News Digest may be heard every Saturday at 9:30 a.m. and again on Wednesday at 2:30 p.m. Central Time on Worldwide KFUO Radio. It may also be heard anytime streaming online at kfuo.org. Join us again next Saturday for another new edition of World Lutheran News Digest. I'm your host, Kip Allen.
World Lutheran News Digest is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. WLN Digest is produced through the facilities of Worldwide KFUO. You can also listen to WLN Digest on demand at kfuo.org. To correspond with World Lutheran News Digest, email news@kfuo.org.